Pekina.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Tennis, the number one tennis podcast with your host, Keith Fraser. Yes, that's me. And my sidekick and former British number one, Mr. John Lloyd. Okay, so welcome to another edition of Rock and Roll Tennis. I'm here with, as always, my main man, obviously, the bronzed Adonis, the Englishman in Florida, the housewife, heartthrob, as I like to call him, Mr. John Lloyd. John, how are you doing?
Great, great. It's a bit of a rainy day here in Fort Lauderdale, but it's still 85 degrees, so I can't complain too much.
Well, listen, the weather's good in London here today, so nor am I going to complain. But look, we've got a fantastic guest. You know, when you go into a restaurant or in a hotel, what is the one thing we all want is service with a smile. And this guest is all about that. He doesn't work in a restaurant. He doesn't work in a hotel, not that I know, because he's retired from tennis now. But always service with a smile. 2006 Australian Open runner-up from Cyprus, where I visited a few times. He was... Big fans' favourite. He is, of course, Marcos Baghdatis. Marcos, welcome.
Hey, Kate. Hey, John. How are you guys? All good?
We're good, mate. All the better for seeing you. Listen, Marcos, I don't know if you know, because I'm a bit older than you. John's a little bit older than me. But I'm the odd one out here. And the odd one out here, of course, because like I said, I'm just the man who talks the talk. You guys walk the walk. You guys have both been in the Australian Open final. Did you know that John was in the Australian Open final before?
Yes, yes. Which year was that?
Oh God, that was too many years ago, Marcos. And in my day,
sorry,
it was lucky because a lot of the top players didn't like to play the Australian Open because it started on the 26th of December, and a lot of players didn't want to spend Christmas in Australia. And for me, it was like I had the choice of either being in England, freezing cold, or going to Australia for a month. So I said, I'll go to Australia. So the year I played, there was a few players that weren't in the top 10. There were still some good players, but, you know, I was fortunate. But all I remember, though, Marcos, is by the time they took taxes out of my prize money check, I ended up with $12,500. A little bit different now.
Yeah.
Actually,
big difference.
When
big
you
difference.
Think about it, I
big
just want to ask you,
when
John,
you play too.
Yeah.
John, you didn't go because it was obviously beautiful weather. It was around Christmas time. Did you still buy people Christmas presents?
No, I got away with buying Christmas presents. No, I left a month early, so I didn't bother. I was, the only trouble is I didn't receive any either. Well, I had a few Christmas presents when I was in Australia, but that's another story.
Well, look, two Australian Open finalists in the house. Listen, Marcos, obviously you come from Cyprus. I've been to Cyprus. Many of my friends are Greek Cypriot. And how did you get into tennis? I mean, is it a big sport in Cyprus? How did you get involved?
It definitely wasn't. When I started playing tennis, it was like a very small sport. You know, my older brothers, I have two older brothers, Marinos and Petros, which are 8 and 6 years older than me. They play tennis. So basically my family says that I was actually born on a tennis court, you know, and my father was always carrying me to the club in his hands in the push chair. And yeah, I was just spending so much time in the tennis club. And then they say some people, I mean, my parents say that I was always holding a racket in my hand, you know, when after I was 2-3 years old, when I started walking, picking up balls on the court with my brother. So, yeah, it was just, you know, for me, tennis was from early years of my life.
And from what I know, you listen, John was Davis Cup captain of Great Britain, but you were playing Davis Cup from the age of 14.
Yes, my first cup was in Uganda, actually. January in 2000. So yeah, it was a good experience, a good life experience to see, you know, to travel to a country like Uganda and see, you know, all the kids playing soccer in the streets, and you know, like the way Uganda was as a country, you know, and was a great experience for me. And just playing in those conditions was just an amazing experience. Learned a lot in life from that trip.
And am I right? Keith, one thing just quickly.
I admire a lot about Marcos. I love the way he played. I loved his attitude on court. But one of the things I really admired was the fact that he supported Davis Cup even when he was top 10 in the world. And Cyprus, you know, were never in the top division of the world group. And yet he still played every match. And there were a lot of other top players who I won't mention that didn't play when they were out of the top division. And I could never understand that, because for me, it was always an honour to play for your country. If you were in Division 8, it made no difference. And I think Marcos is a prime example of that, is someone who supported Davis Cup, even though his team wasn't so good. Other than him, he didn't have the support to become a world group team. But you still played every single year. And I always thought that was tremendous from you to do that.
Yeah, thanks, John. But, you know, I left home when I was 14. You know, like when I played Davis Cup in Uganda in January in 2000, then in February I went to the Bob Brett Tennis Academy, which was in Paris, managed by Patrick Mouratoglou, his agency back then. He had a sports agency. And you know, like for me, Davis Cup is not just a country, it's a family. You know, it's... Mm. I grew up with all the players. They, you know, the older players that were playing at that time helped me develop as a person, because they were all, I mean, my brother was in the Davis Cup, the friends of my brother. So I felt like it was a family thing, you know, it was just playing with family and playing with a couple of friends. So, I mean, playing for your country, honoring your country. And for me, it was very important. And I got so much energy from playing Davis Cup. For me, it was so important for me to just pass a week of the year with those people and lift me up, you know, throughout my career.
You must be a little bit sad, Marcos. Sorry, Keith, just a quick one last Davis Cup thing. You must be a little bit sad now with the way the Davis Cup has become. For me, I'm tremendously sad. It seems like it's become something now that didn't exist when I was playing, and I think when you were playing, and now it doesn't resemble what the Davis Cup used to be at all. What do you think about that?
I would agree with you for the main reason is that, you know, small countries like Cyprus cannot have Davis Cup in their country, you know, or other countries like Argentina, Colombia, where, you know, you can play in your own country. It's a big plus. You don't have so many tournaments in those countries. And as a player, I would love to play in front of my, I mean, home crowd and bring tennis into my country. And kind of it helps develop tennis, because it's a big thing, especially when you have big players, small countries with big players. It helps develop the sport in the country. And you give motivation to young kids. You make them dream in a way. And it's really important to have that. And unfortunately, you know, sometimes it's a business thing, you know, and like every life, unfortunately. And, you know, we're developing in that way in every aspect of life. And it's, for me, it's a bit sad to see, because it's not only about business sometimes. It's also about emotion. It's also about enjoying the moments, enjoying life and really appreciating these moments.
Yeah,
I don't know if you know, Marcos, that John is the captain of one of the teams in World Team Tennis, which is obviously a team format, of course. Did you ever get the chance to play World Team Tennis? I mean, it sounds like you enjoyed that team atmosphere of the sport. Did you ever get the chance to play that?
I didn't, unfortunately. It was, you know, it was timing was not good. You know, the timing in the summer for me was not good.
Yeah.
Needed to, you know, play the tournaments in the U.S. and, you know, just to go to the U.S. and just play team tennis would cost me other tournaments, and I couldn't afford to lose those tournaments, especially on one of my favorite surface. But I played other team matches. I played in the Indian League. I played the IPTL. And like you say, I love the spirit, the team spirit. I just love it. And I think it's so important to have that team spirit.
You left Cyprus when you were 14, didn't you, to go to France? That is hard. No?
Yes.
How did you cope with that?
It wasn't my decision. I mean, I always loved, and my parents and my brothers kind of prepared me, because my older brother tried to be a professional tennis player. Unfortunately, he had a huge car accident and was, you know, in a hospital for a year and a half. So he couldn't, you know, continue being professional. And they kind of prepared me as a young, from a young age. When I was a kid, 7, 8 years old, I was telling everybody that one day I'm going to leave. And, you know, it made me dream. I'm going to leave. I'm going to go play professional tennis. I'm going to leave Cyprus, go to an academy, you know, work hard. You know, it kind of prepared me. And my father saw it in me, so that I am capable of doing all these sacrifices to become a tennis player. And he took the decision with my mother. And at 14, I went to Paris alone. It was very hard, in the beginning. But I learned, I matured so fast. I took responsibility so early in my life, and it helped me become the person I am and have the results that I had in tennis.
Mm. Would you have done that, fantastic, John? Would you have moved abroad had you been from a smaller country, no disrespect, and you would you have been able to manage that away from the family at such a young age?
I think it would have been difficult. I admire Marcos for doing that. I was started traveling on the road at 16, which I thought was young, and I was one of the youngest out there. And as Marcos said, you grow up quickly, and I was with people that were in their 20s, and you know, you learn to, you know, to adapt pretty quickly and mature. Otherwise, you sort of get left behind. But at 14, that was difficult. But I heard Marcus mention that he was involved a little bit with Bob Brett. Bob Brett was my coach, my last coach before he went on to better things after me, and then coached, you know, Boris Becker and obviously Marcos and Goran and other people. But I love Bob Brett. So that's another thing we have in common.
Yeah,
evidently. And I know the. I know also, Marcos, you roomed with Dudi Seller, who I think is still a good pal of yours?
Yes.
Because I have met him a few times at his home base in Ramat HaSharon in Israel. A talented player, for sure. How did you guys... I know that you beat him on the tour, but obviously you're still in touch and good pals, no?
Yeah, I mean, one of my best friends on tour. We grew up with Dudi even before I went to Paris. The year before, when we were playing under 14 tournaments, like in Tarbes and Orange Bowl and all these tournaments, we were traveling. He was traveling with his father. I was traveling with my father. Sometimes we were sharing rooms together, you know, eating every dinner together. Every tournament we played doubles together. And we got really close. He's kind of person that actually is so nice being around, you know. And
he's a lovely guy.
Unbelievable talent. Yeah, lovely guy, lovely guy.
But, listen, I want to go back to that year, 2006. You were unseeded. You got to the Australian Open final. And to be fair, when I was watching you in that final, a set and a break up on Federer. Wow, do you ever look back on that event and thinking, oh my goodness, you kick yourself and think, I could have done it. I could have won the whole damn thing against arguably the greatest ever.
Definitely. I mean, especially when people like you mention it.
sorry.
No, of course I have moments that I think about that, and I speak about it with, you know, with my wife and also with some friends, you know, and everybody says, you were so close. Of course I was so close. And yeah, just that moment, I saw victory, and that's what you shouldn't do, you know. And I was I got away from my own, I always call it like a balloon, where you're like not thinking, just playing, just swinging and just seeing the ball very big. And And somehow I got distracted because I started thinking a bit more. And yeah, unfortunately, you cannot afford to do that against champions like Federer. And I could afford to do it maybe with another player at that time, but not with Roger. And yeah, he took advantage of that. And I mean, started raising his level. And when he raises his level, when you show him there is a weak spot, he just doesn't let go, and that's why he's there where he is.
Yeah.
You remember that final, John?
Mm. I do remember that final, yeah. And as Marco said, it's a difficult thing sometimes, because when you're in the zone, which is what I call it, when the ball is just coming off your string beautifully and you feel like you can't miss, And then everything is beautiful in the world. You're just striking the ball, and the ball feels like a football. You can't miss it. It feels so big, you know, it's easy. And then if you think about it too much for 1 second, you know, it can change around quickly, and you can think of circumstances and who's playing on the other side of the net, and the whole game can change. And that's why, you know, focus-wise, in my era, obviously, there were great players, just like with Marcos. But I remember, you know, for me, the toughest in some ways looking at the person was a Bjorn Borg, because, you know, I once had him. I think I told you this story, Keith. I was up against him in Memphis in the indoor tour, and I was up 6-love, 2-love against him. And I think he had an argument with his wife the night before or something, because he obviously had a hangover, and I was beating him. And I thought, wow, I'm beating the best player in the world. And I looked across the net at him, and I remember looking at him, and he just gave me a look as if to say, you know, you've still got a long way to go before you beat me. And I remember thinking, you know, and my whole mind sort of changed after that. And sure enough, I lost the match. And you can't blink these days. You get against the top players, you can't blink. Otherwise, they're going to come after you. And that's you know, that can happen.
And sorry to cut, but the other thing is you cannot have emotions, unfortunately. I mean, you cannot. Yeah. You can, but you have to be able to control your emotions. And I think, you know, Roger Federer told me in 2016 in Halle, we had a discussion, and, you know, we talked about my career a bit, you know, and it was my birthday, actually. And he told me, I mean, we talked about my career, and he told me, like, kind of my thing that was not, like, disadvantage was I was too emotional. I couldn't control my emotions. And, yeah, and I think he was kind of right. He analyzed it right, because it's so important to be able to control your emotions, get into that zone, like John said, and where you don't think about anything. You see the ball so big, and you have a feeling that you're not running on the court, you're walking. It's like, everything is so smooth, and yeah, it's so true. And if you see the best players in the world are right now are the ones that don't show emotions. They're so focused on the task, and you know, and that's how they do it. I mean, it's very tough to get to that thing, but yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, Marcos, because that year when you got to the final of the Australian Open and you got to the semis at Wimbledon, I think it was, I can't remember who it was. Who beat you in the semis at Wimbledon? Was it Nadal?
Yes.
Nadal. I, you know, that was obviously an unbelievable year. I don't mean to be disrespectful, because obviously you had an amazing career. Yeah. But that was the best year of your career in respect to the slams. Do you feel... What was it that,
yes.
What was it that actually happened, you know, after that? Because you didn't manage to rediscover that height.
I mean, 2007, I played again. I played quarterfinal, fourth round French Open, which, you know, on clay, I wasn't that good throughout my career. And that 2007, the year after, I played fourth round. I played quarterfinals in Wimbledon, losing to Djokovic 7-5 in the fifth in 2007. And, you know, I needed maybe a bit more, how you say, experience, more times. People, after having a great year like that, they start to know your game, know how you play, know your weaknesses. So I had to change some things, which I tried, and I was on the good road, because 2007, still not having the great year in Grand Slams, but I managed to play a few finals, win one tournament, you know, play quarterfinals of Wimbledon. I was pretty consistent. Finished the year 14 in the world, 16 in the world, and was very close to making the Masters again. If I won Paris at the end of the year, I would make the Masters. I lost in the semifinals against Rafa. So it wasn't, the year after wasn't that bad. The thing started when 2008, I had three different injuries, you know, and it started from Indian Wells, didn't play until French Open. And then after Wimbledon, I got a wrist injury, which I didn't play Olympics. I didn't play US Open at the end of the year. After that, when I came back, I had a small disc problem with my back. And, you know, and then confidence started not to believe in myself. You know, when you're not training the same, when you're scared to put the extra work because of your body, you start to lose your confidence. You start to that belief that you can beat those guys. And then, you know, and then you see all the other guys, the young guys like Murray was coming up, Wawrinka, Berdych, Tsonga, you know, where they start building up. And then you kind of, you know, you try to rush a bit, try to come back very fast, you know, because, and then you slip a bit. And then, you know, new things come and it goes so fast. And you take some decisions that, you know, that don't go your way. And it's like, you know, it's like, but I, like you said, it's not, I think I lost some belief in me. And that's it. And unfortunately, I maybe didn't find the right, you know, people around me to the right mentor to change that and find a way. And that's it. It's not an excuse, but it's the way it was. And you know, and but I'm not. Everybody, a lot of people are asking me if I ever regret the decisions I've made, and I say no, because when I was 14, if somebody tells me you go to Paris and you become the player you would become, I would sign immediately. So, and I'm very grateful for what I have today. So, and it's because of the decisions that I took, you know.
Listen, you both are very lucky. I said to John a long time ago, if there's one thing I would have loved to have been. In fact, I think I said to you in the first episode, John, didn't I, that there's only one thing I would rather have been ahead of being a professional tennis player walking out on Centre Court Wimbledon, and that is the lead guitarist of a rock band. But actually, as it turns out, I didn't make either. But there you go, there you go. I've got no regrets, Marcos, like you, no regrets. But actually, here's the question, because great players like Federer, Nadal, and all the great players in history, I think there's got to be an element of luck to it as well, because I could name a few players who've been very unlucky with injuries, like yourself. I can think of Pat Cash in his day, Juan Martín del Potro, a number of players who I would say, had they not had the injuries, would have achieved that much more. I don't know if you had a lot of injuries in your time, John, but this is to both of you. Would you say that there is luck in really getting to the real unbelievable heights of the game, and that is down to the physiology and your body?
Marcos, you want to answer that, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, my opinion, definitely you need a bit of luck. I mean, not in the matches, but in the people you're surrounded with. You start a career, you're very young, you know, you have to be lucky to find the right people. You talked about Roger, Nadal, Djokovic. Those guys, I mean, have the same team throughout their career. Why? Because it's just a chemistry that fits in with two people, three people, whatever the team is. You see Djokovic, he changed from Vida one point. He got lost. He couldn't. He came back. He found himself. Severin with Roger. I mean, Tony Nadal with Rafa. You know, and let's take another example like Wawrinka. Since he started with Magnus Norman, you know, they're so connected. He stopped a while with him. He had troubles. You know, it's finding that person who can, you know, you can fit as not as only as a coach, but as a person, because you're spending so much time with him. It's like a marriage, you know, and it's not always easy to find that person that you can, you know, do your life with, spend the rest of your career with. And I think it's really important, and you need a bit of luck for that.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that, John?
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree exactly what Michael said there. I think that, you know, finding the right people around you, there's a little bit of luck there. I mean, I think also the physical side. I mean, someone like, you know, Juan Del Potro, you mentioned him, Keith. I have no doubts that if his body hadn't let him down so many times, he would have won more than one Grand Slam. I don't think there's any question there. And someone like Roger Federer, who until really, the last 3 years, three, maybe 4 years, had never had an injury before. Basically, you've got to have a bit of luck not to have ever missed a Grand Slam in about 11 years, which I think was basically his record. So that, I mean, listen, he's a great player, and I can't take that away from him, but there has to be a little bit of luck involved, I think, at certain times to be a champion. But you know, the great ones, obviously, you know, their minds are I think, what separates them. There's that little bit in them that it's difficult to describe, but you know, they just never think they're going to be beaten. They just I always thought it was interesting with Jimmy Connors as an example, and my ex first wife Chris Evert, both of them said the same thing when they get on the court, and I always thought that when you won a great match, that you know, that your feeling you had, that it was you couldn't wait to shake hands knowing that you won. That was, to me, obviously, the feeling that you got, what you played the game for. But Jimmy Connors and Chris Evert both said the thing that drove them most was they couldn't bear the thought of shaking hands and seeing the other person actually beating them. That was what drove them on. It was kind of a reverse of what someone like myself thought, which is why maybe I was a good player, but certainly not a great player, because that never entered my head. But for them, it was like the absolute fear factor of seeing someone actually shake their hands and have beaten them drove them to ridiculous positions where they would almost die on the court to win the match, you know.
Actually, you've both got like something else in common, because obviously, John, you were married to Chris Evert, and I know you, Marcos, your wife is Carolina Sprem, is that correct?
Yes.
How is it being married? I mean, obviously John's answered it, but being married to a fellow professional, how is it? Is there any sort of, I don't know when you met her, maybe you can tell us, but was there ever any competition, or was it just willing each other on all the time? And how's the dynamic there?
I think it's understanding each other, understanding what each other does in his job, in his profession, and definitely pushing each other. I mean, having discussions and, you know, finding ways to motivate each other. And I think that's what, you know, how we helped each other. Unfortunately, Carolina also had so many injuries. She was a great player. She could have done so much more, but had like very serious injuries with her elbow and wrist. And since you know, I met Carolina, I became a better person and a better, actually a better player at one point, you know, even though it was later in my career, I improved at one point because she saw the game a bit differently than me. And as having somebody that you trust so much in your team and knowing, went through the same things like you, helped you improve. And it's just like, again, a chemistry between two people.
So you think, obviously, it was for you, obviously, worked well. But John, do you think your career would have been even better had you not been married to a fellow pro, and obviously a top pro, who she was? Do you think your career suffered as a result of that?
Well, I mean, it suffered for a couple of years because I almost sort of gave up so that I could be with Chris and help her. She was she had a drastic she went down from number one in the world to number three. Oh my gosh, that was enough for her to almost jump off the nearest bridge. But you know, I helped her train and get back to number one, and consequently, my ranking went down from, you know, in the 20s down to about 500. But that was a lot my own fault. It was different for me because the difference between me and Chris was so much in terms of our career. You know, would it have been better if I hadn't have been? You know, I'm not going to blame Chris for that because that was my own doing. I wanted to help her. And to be honest, you know, for me as a player, I didn't get to the heights that perhaps I could have done because basically I wasn't as dedicated as I should have done. And unlike Marcos, which it's great that he has no regrets, I have regrets, you know, because I didn't work as hard as I should have done. And that was purely my own fault. And that's when I work with players now. I don't work with many players, but, you know, the thing I try and emphasize is that this career is very short in tennis. I mean, 1 minute you're 18 years old and then the next minute you wake up and you're 30. It goes so quick in a blink of an eye. And you try your hardest. Give it 100% so that when you quit the game, at least whatever ranking you finish at, if you can say that you gave it all, then you've been a success. And in my case, you know, I was lazy at times and didn't work as hard. So I'm not going to blame my ex for that, though. That was my own fault.
Can I ask you, Marcos, what was your proudest moment in all your career? Because I've got something that I think I can think of, but I want to hear it from you.
Honestly, my proudest moment is to that I brought so many kids in my own country to be able to play the sport. You know, tennis in Cyprus was such a small sport. Back then, before I even started playing tennis, there was 5-6 tennis clubs in Cyprus with tennis courts with one coach on them. Now there are about maybe 12 with 6 coach on every in each club. And you know, bringing kids in sports, in tennis, was for me the proudest moment. And also bringing tennis in Cyprus as the second biggest sport right now, it's just amazing. And I feel kind of happy, but also kind of responsible that I need now, I want this now to continue. So that's for me the proudest moment and the proudest thing that I ever feel that I've done.
You've obviously been the torchbearer for the sport in Cyprus, but that's exactly where I'm going, because you held the Cypriot flag, I think it was at the London Olympics.
Yeah.
That must have been a proud moment for you.
Definitely. Definitely, especially like we said about Davis Cup, it's the same thing with Olympics. It's something that every child in the world, every person in the world who is involved with sports is their dream. And the dream is not just to play Olympics or compete in the Olympics, is to hold that flag, you know. And that definitely was the best moment, especially playing the Olympics on grass that year and in London, which is, I think, the biggest city in the world for sports events. It just was an amazing feeling. And it's something that I will always be proud of.
By the way, guys, John, we're going to come on to this again, because Marcos said that London is the biggest city in the world for sporting events, but it's actually the biggest city in the world for the biggest football club. And I know that you're going to argue that, Marcos, because I know that you support Apollon, I think it is, in Limassol, but in England, yes, you're another Manchester United fan, is that right?
Yes.
We had Jamie Delgado the other day, who's also a Man United fan. And have a guess which team John supports, if you haven't been listening to previous editions of Rock and Roll Tennis.
I'll guess Man United, right?
No.
John,
no.
We'll reveal all.
City?
No, Wolverhampton Wanderers, Marcos.
Oh, nice.
Yes, Man United are a bit of a different league, but we're coming. We're coming to get you this year.
How do you think your team's going to do?
I mean, they finished off. I mean, Man United finished off so well. I love what Solskjaer is doing. I think they're taking the right direction. And it's like everything, you know, you need a plan, you need a structure. And Man United I believe they didn't have that the last 5 years since Sir Alex left. And I think they're starting to get there, and they're investing in the young kids, and you know, they're working with structure. And I think that's the only way you can succeed. And you need time, you need patience, and you need self-discipline and structure. So I think they're on the right track. So maybe this year, as a fan, I'm not expecting so many things, but I like the way the road they're taking. And I hope in the next few years they will get the team back where it belongs.
Well, I think it's a very competitive league, as John says. Wolves are pretty damn good now, and they've got a lot of ambition. My club, Arsenal, I think are heading in the right direction. It's a very, very exciting Premier League now. I cannot see. And you guys, as former professional tennis players, I have this belief that Liverpool will not do it this season, because two seasons ago they were so close. They almost reached 100 points. They came second. Last season they were unbelievable. I just think that mentally, I'm not convinced they'll have that same level of intensity. And as tennis players, would I be right in saying that that would be similar to you guys if you guys had really given it your all to whatever it may be, to win a slam, to win a tournament the next week after or whenever it is? Would you say that your mental level would probably not be as intense? Either of you?
Go ahead, Marco.
So, yeah, I it's tough to agree with that, because I think Jurgen Klopp is a great coach and he has so much experience in that, and he showed it that, you know, the last two seasons they're just playing unbelievable. They're the best team in the world right now, from my eyes. And I think he will find a way again to be close. Maybe, I don't know if he's going to win it or not, but I think he's going to continue the same level they are. And if he will need to bring some extra players in, I think he will. And he knows his job, so I think they're in the right track.
What do you think, John? Do you think mentally it's hard after you've done something great to keep that intensity going?
Well, and I think it's different for teams than an individual sport. I actually don't think Liverpool win this year. I think Man City will. But in terms of tennis, I think it depends on the person. The great champions, that they never take a holiday. They're thirsty for more. They win a Grand Slam, they want to win the next one. They win a tournament, they want to win the next one. Me, myself, in my career, when I had a good run, I was thinking about having a holiday for a few weeks and enjoying the fruits of my labour. But that's a different mentality. And that's why I wasn't a champion at that level like the champions are, because they want to keep on. It's a never-ending quest to be better than they were the week before. That's their attitude. That's their mindset. And that's what makes them so great.
Look, thank you so much, Marcos. It's nice to see that smile again. I hope you've enjoyed this as much as you have done on all those times when you stepped on court and you had that enormous grin. And when you're in London, let us know. And if John's around, the three of us will go and watch a football match. How about it?
Definitely.
All right, well, listen.
Guys, thank you so much for everything. Thank you for
having me. Nice to see you, Marcos.
Nice to see you, John.
Be well. Good to see you. Thanks a lot and keep safe. Marcos Baghdatis, everybody. Thank you. John, what a top guy, Marcos Baghdatis there. Lovely guy, no?
Fabulous, yeah. Well, he's got the right attitude, and I love what he said about the end, about his proudest moment. And just think of that. Just imagine if you were capable, in whatever you sport or whatever, that you basically have created a boom in your industry. And for him, from being a country where the sport was, way down on the scale, to now being the second most popular, and it's because of him.
Yeah.
What a thing to be to be known for. I mean, to feel that, and he talked, the way he carried himself on court was always fun. Whenever you watched him, he had that, and maybe, as he said, deep down, maybe if he'd have, his attitude had been slightly different, perhaps he would have maybe won a few more matches. But on the other hand, would have been as much fun to watch, because he had that attitude on court that drew you to watch him. and he was an entertainer. Yeah. And, you know, he was, you know, he was a Kyrgios, and I don't mean with the antics, but, you know, you're drawn to watch Kyrgios and Monfils because you never know what they're going to do. And and Monfils will play these shots and have these smiles on his face. Well, Marcos Bagdatis was like that. And you know, he thrilled us in so many ways. And, yeah, what a great ambassador for the sport.
I was thinking also Guga, because Guga was a really loved
another
player.
One. Absolutely. Yeah. Another great example.
Just loved. Yeah. Every time he stepped on court, particularly the Parisian crowd just absolutely loved him. But, listen, that was great. I enjoyed it. I enjoy it all the time talking to you, John. You know, I say this every week, don't I? I sound like a broken record, but it is great. Great to have Marcos on.
It's fun.
Yeah, definitely. Well, listen, John, keep well, keep safe. We'll do this again next week. Thanks so much,
definitely.
John.
Take care.
Take care, my friend. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Please remember to press that subscribe button and share with all your friends. You can also follow us on Twitter, RNR_tennis, and, of course, on Instagram, RockAndRoll_tennis. And please, leave us a review. We'd love to hear your comments. We will, of course, see you next week, as always. Thanks so much again.